KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The suspect in the political assassination of a Minnesota lawmaker is in custody. We'll hear from Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who was with the former speaker, Melissa Hortman, the night before she was killed. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration demands all elections records from Colorado. Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Voting experts say they've never heard of a request this sweeping. What does it say about the new focus at the Department of Justice? One international student tells us how the travel ban affects his plans to study at his dream school in the U.S. It is Monday, June 16th. On this day in 1911, Charles Flint combined four businesses into the Computing Tabulating Recording Company. It eventually stopped making punch cards and turned to computers as IBM. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Kuhlman. President Trump has arrived in the Western Canadian province of Alberta for the G7 summit. It's being held near Calgary. As NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben reports, Trump has one-on-one meetings planned with multiple leaders starting this hour with his Canadian host.
Trump's one-on-ones begin today with a morning meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney. White House officials also confirmed that he will meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum. The White House has said Trump hopes to talk about topics including migration, drug smuggling, and trade at this week's summit. Trump has imposed tariffs on goods from all of his fellow G7 countries. Trump's America First worldview has put him at odds with foreign leaders at past G7s. In his first term, they clashed over climate change and trade. But his team also took issue with G7 agendas, thinking covering non-economic topics like culture and climate change constituted overreach. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Calgary.
There are growing calls for Israel and Iran to de-escalate their conflict. There's been a fourth night of missile and drone launches. In an interview with ABC News over the weekend, President Trump said, quote, "It's possible we could get involved, but we are not at this moment involved," end quote. NPR's Hadil Alshalchi reports from Tel Aviv. The attacks are unprecedented for that Israeli region.
Israelis can sometimes be nonchalant about missile fire. Hamas, Hezbollah, the Yemeni Houthis fire rockets at Israel. But this isn't the same at all. And the Israeli air defense system, known as the Iron Dome, hasn't been able to intercept all of them, as we can see, which is leading to a level of destruction in central Israel, particularly, that hasn't been seen before, really.
NPR's Hadil Alshalchi reporting. President Trump has ordered officials in his administration to expand their deportation campaigns in large, democratically led cities. As NPR's Adrian Florido reports, writing online, Trump said they should do all in their power to achieve his mass deportation goals.
ICE officers are herewith ordered, Trump wrote on Truth Social, to detain and deport illegal aliens in America's largest cities, such as Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. The president went on to accuse Democratic leaders in those and other cities of using immigrants without legal status to expand their voter base and to cheat in elections. There's never been evidence of this. But the president's post suggests that more than a week after ICE agents began aggressive raids in Los Angeles, setting off protests, other large cities could soon expect the same. Trump wrote, quote, "I have directed my entire administration to put every resource possible behind this effort." Adrian Florido, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The New York Times is reporting the Department of Homeland Security will reportedly pause efforts to deport certain migrants. That may include migrants in agriculture and the hotel and restaurant industries. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Authorities in Minnesota have arrested the suspect wanted in the shootings of two state lawmakers and their spouses over the weekend. The former speaker of the Minnesota House and her husband have been killed. Suspect Vance Belter was armed but surrendered to authorities in rural Minnesota yesterday. He had eluded them for 2 days. Indian authorities have started handing over the remains of plane crash victims to their families. More than 250 people were killed last week when a Boeing aircraft bound for London crashed right after takeoff. NPR's Amkar Kandekar reports.
The Associated Press reports that Indian authorities have identified the remains of more than 24 people who died in the fiery air crash in the city of Ahmedabad. Doctors say they are trying to identify others using DNA. Only one passenger survived. Indian investigators say they recovered the aircraft's cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder. The two make up what is commonly known as the black box. They help experts reconstruct the flight's final moments to understand the cause of the air crash. A senior official says a team of American aviation safety experts is at the crash site for its own probe since the aircraft was made in the U.S. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, New Delhi.
Catastrophic flooding in two states has left several people dead. Five people have been killed in West Virginia this weekend and several people are still missing. In San Antonio, Texas, 13 people died in a storm last week. In both states, several inches of rain fell in just a few hours. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And Mae Martinez in Los Angeles, California. A man suspected of killing a Democratic Minnesota legislative leader over the weekend is in custody.
Last night, police arrested Vance Belter in a rural area outside Minneapolis. The 57-year-old is charged with murder. Governor Tim Walz has called it a politically motivated attack.
Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik joins us now from Minneapolis. Matt, let's start with the victims of this attack. Who were they?
Investigators say that Vance Belter posed as a police officer and fatally shot former Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark around 3:30 a.m. Saturday inside their home in Brooklyn Park, a suburb of Minneapolis. Belter's also suspected of shooting and seriously wounding Democratic State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette at their house about 90 minutes earlier. When Hoffman's daughter called 911 to report the shooting, police went to the Hortman's home. According to the criminal complaint, officers saw Belter, who was dressed as a policeman, shoot Mark Hortman through an open door. Police then exchanged gunfire with Belter, who ran through the house and out the back. Belter left a vehicle in the Hortman's driveway that was similar in appearance to a police SUV. Inside it, investigators allegedly found a list of names and addresses of other public officials. At a news conference late last night, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said that the initial 911 call and the officer's decision to check on Hortman stopped the gunman from killing other public officials. The Democratic governor pleaded for civility in public life.
This cannot be the norm. It cannot be the way that we deal with our political differences. Now's the time for us to recommit to the core values of this country.
Matt, where was Belter caught?
Yesterday morning, residents of rural Sibley County, that's about 50 miles southwest of Minneapolis, got cell phone alerts telling them to lock their homes and vehicles. That was after police found a car belonging to Belter down the road from his home in that area. Brooklyn Park Police Chief Mark Brulee says an officer thought that he may have seen Belter run into the woods, so authorities hurried to set up a perimeter.
During that, we got privy to additional information of an individual that was in the woods, and that search went on for many hours until ultimately we were able to locate him in the woods.
Brulee says officers called Belter out of the forest and into a field where he surrendered. The chief called the operation the largest manhunt in Minnesota history and said 20 SWAT teams were involved with it. Authorities say Belter was armed, but they did not specify what type of weapon he had.
Does anyone know any motive for what happened?
Authorities didn't offer any new information about Belter's alleged motive, but several Democratic elected officials, including U.S. Senator Tina Smith and Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, confirmed that they were among those on the list of people allegedly targeted by Belter. Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Superintendent Drew Evans added last night that the list included names of people from other states, including Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, Nebraska, and Iowa.
Now, one more thing. The couple who survived the attack, how are they doing?
Yvette Hoffman was struck by 8 bullets, and her husband, State Senator John Hoffman, was hit 9 times. Governor Walz said last night that John Hoffman came out of his final surgery and is moving toward recovery. Yvette Hoffman exchanged text messages with U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar yesterday, writing, quote, "We are both incredibly lucky to be alive."
All right, that's reporter Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio. Matt, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota was with Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband the night before they were killed. They were all at a dinner together, and Senator Klobuchar is with us now. Good morning, Senator. We are so very sorry for your loss.
Well, thank you, Michelle. And our state mourns this incredible woman who I just wish all your listeners would have known her. She was such a strong speaker. Even some of the Republican legislators have called her one of the most consequential speakers in Minnesota history. She ushered through with the governor free school lunch and expansive paid family leave, and then was able to negotiate in a tied state house a budget this year. And mostly she was just a delightful person. I got to know her. We were both moms in politics and campaigning door to door with little kids. And I just saw her grow and come into this incredible power that she had and that she used so well for the good of our state and the country. And we're going to miss her and her husband, Mark.
So thanks so much for sharing those memories. I was going to ask you what your memories of her were, so thank you for that. You know, investigators are calling this a targeted killing. They say the suspect had a hit list or several. What are you hearing about the motive? And do you think that there's an ongoing threat to you and other officials in Minnesota?
First of all, I think Senator Thune and Schumer have upped our security here as well as others in the state. This is an ongoing threat to elected officials overall, not this particular man. We thank law enforcement for this incredible work, as you just heard from your reporter, biggest manhunt in the history of Minnesota. Citizens, over 400 tips called in, including one that was critical to finding him, and citizens doing their jobs as well. One of the things that came out yesterday is there actually were multiple lists. It wasn't just one list, although there's been a focus on one list. We learned from federal law enforcement, for instance, that I was on another list with lawmakers whose names haven't been made public. So there were, he seemed to, I know NPR have not been calling this a manifesto, probably for good reason. It was a collection of documents which contained multiple lists and other things about issues. We also know abortion providers like Planned Parenthood were on the list. So the ongoing threat is, first of all, they've got to finish their investigation, get the charges done, do everything right so this man never gets out again. Secondly, we in Washington, throughout our country, you know, people have to look at the mirror who are engaging in this rhetoric that has inflamed already difficult time in our country, that are posting things on social media that people actually start believing and then acting out on it. And so I just think my hope is in Melissa's memory and her incredible work that people are going to reassess how they act in politics and how they treat each other.
Do you see any evidence of that? I mean, even among some of your colleagues who have been, you know, making certain claims about the person's motives that for which there's no
totally.
Evidence. I mean, do you see any evidence of that people are willing to reconsider the way they conduct their, you know, public speech and the way they conduct themselves in public life?
Well, when I get back, I'm going to talk to those colleagues. I can tell you that much. But In Minnesota, we did do a joint, every single from Tom Emmer, myself on, we did a joint statement, every member of our delegation from the most conservative to the liberal, that said we speak with one voice and condemn this politically motivated violence. And I think that has to continue, as well as looking at security for members. There's been an increase from 2016 of 1,700 threats against members to last year, Michelle, over 9,000 threats against members. And we're seeing the same thing in the judiciary.
So, you know, you also lived through the January 6th attack on the Capitol. So, and you've been in public life for decades. And I just, forgive me for asking, but it does make me wonder whether this causes you to rethink anything of your, about your desire to stay in this.
Not one bit. I just believe, when I've talked to people during these last few days in my state, in Melissa's memory, I hope that it doesn't cause people not to run, because we need people in office like her. We need people who are willing to get things done, willing to take tough votes and make decisions that are best for this country, and willing to actually bring down the rhetoric. And I've made my life's work of trying to work across the aisle, trying to find common ground, of course, standing my ground, calling people out. But that's been a big part of what I've tried to do. And I'm going to double down on it even more. But finding people who are willing to run is so important. Yes, we need more security, and that's got to be a priority. But a lot of this is making sure that people who cherish our democracy actually stand up for our democracy and run for office.
That is Senator Amy Klobuchar. She's a Democrat from Minnesota. Senator Klobuchar, once again, our condolences, and we thank you so much for talking with us at such a difficult time.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Lawyers from Harvard University and the Trump administration are back in court today. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports the hearing in federal court is about Harvard's ability to enroll international students.
The issue in front of the court today is about President Trump's June 4th proclamation preventing Harvard's international students from entering the country. The order cited national security concerns. The Trump administration has argued that Harvard violated students' civil rights, including failing to protect Jewish students, and that banning the school from enrolling international students is warranted. Harvard swiftly sued, and federal judge Alison D. Burroughs, an Obama appointee, issued a temporary block. Today's hearing will determine if the judge indefinitely blocks Trump's order until the lawsuit goes to trial. In a statement, Harvard called the move, quote, another illegal retaliatory step, unquote, and said that it's in violation of the school's First Amendment rights. It has maintained that it will continue enrolling international students, which make up more than a quarter of the school's student body, based on the temporary order of the court. Many of Harvard's international students, there are about 7,000, are anxiously awaiting today's proceedings.
This court hearing is a very big deal for international students.
Alfred Williamson just finished his first year at Harvard. He's from Wales.
The part that's most frustrating and scary is that there's nothing that we can do to influence the outcome. We just have to sit here, wait, and cross our fingers.
The Trump administration has been locked in a back and forth with Harvard, the world's wealthiest university, for several months. The government has canceled grants, threatened the school's tax-exempt status, and attempted to block international students from enrolling. The presidential order at question in today's hearing was the first time Trump has stepped in directly, using his executive powers to limit Harvard. For Williamson and thousands of others, this hearing is just another step in an uncertain future.
This fight seems far from over, and as international students, we really can't see the end of it.
Williamson's sophomore year at Harvard hangs in the balance. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Elizabeth Brunig joins us to talk about her haunting New Atlantic cover story about serving as a witness to state-sanctioned executions. We'll talk about what she saw, what it means, and how covering the death penalty has shaped her faith. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Last month, President Trump's Department of Justice made a sweeping demand to the state of Colorado. Give us all your records from recent federal elections. Voting officials say they've never seen anything like it. NPR's Miles Parks and Jude Joffe Block were the first to obtain this data request. So, Jude, let's start off with you. Tell us more about what's happening here.
Well, yeah, last month, the Justice Department sent the Colorado Secretary of State a letter citing a number of federal laws, including those that say election officials need to keep relevant records for 22 months after an election. DOJ said they received a complaint about Colorado's compliance with election law, and they're requesting all records from the past 22 months as a result. But this request goes even further back to preserve any 2020 election records Colorado has, even though there isn't a legal obligation for state officials to have saved those old records at this point.
All right, so requests for both 2020 and 2024. Miles, how rare is this?
I mean, no voting official we've spoken with has ever heard of a request for all election records from an entire state. I mean, depending on how you read this, election law experts told us it could encompass ballots, voter registration materials to equipment. Justin Levitt is a professor at Loyola Law School. He worked for DOJ during the Obama administration, and he was a voting advisor in the Biden administration.
But I've never seen a request that says you have a responsibility to keep everything. We're investigating whether you kept everything. So send us everything.
Has the Department of Justice said anything about this request so far publicly or maybe in response to your reporting?
It hasn't. We got no comment on the substance of the request, and the DOJ also has not provided a copy of the initial complaint.
What about the letter? Any explanation as to why they want all these records?
Not exactly. I mean, we don't know anything about that initial complaint, who sent it, what the specifics are. But election officials in Colorado note the last time that a state records retention issue was in the spotlight involved a Trump ally who's become a sort of election denial folk hero. You might remember her name, Tina Peters. She's a former county voting official who was convicted on a bunch of crimes related to giving unauthorized access to her systems after the 2020 election. As part of her defense in her trial, she accused the Secretary of State of illegally ordering records to be deleted. That accusation was never substantiated, but election officials in Colorado see this request from DOJ as in some way linked to that case.
All right, so just to be clear then, anything in the DOJ's letter that mentions Peters, or is that maybe just a hunch among people in Colorado?
There's nothing in the letter, but it's also worth noting that just a week before Colorado got this letter, President Trump posted a long social media post where he called Peters a political prisoner, and he even directed DOJ to take, quote, all necessary action to help get her free, even though she's in state custody.
And when we spoke with Colorado's Secretary of State, Democrat Jenna Griswold, she noted the timing that this request came soon after Trump's post. Though she's not sure why DOJ ultimately wants all her records, she is worried they'll be used to make false accusations about the state's voting systems.
we are seeing them use the apparatus of the federal government to undermine our elections and our democracy, and I would assume that this is more of the same.
In response to the request, the state provided DOJ with a couple different snapshots of its publicly available voter rolls and a more detailed voter history. But it's unclear whether DOJ will be satisfied with that, considering how broad the request was.
Jude, I mean, what does this data request then say about the focus of Trump's Department of Justice?
Yeah, the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, which includes the voting section, is really undergoing a dramatic transformation right now to home in on Trump's priorities. We've seen DOJ lawyers drop voting rights lawsuits brought under Biden and instead focus on searching for fraud or how states are verifying voters on their rolls. One of our colleagues reported that the Civil Rights Division has lost about 70% of its attorneys. The key person to note here is the head of the Civil Rights Division, Harmeet Dhillon. She's the one who signed this request to Colorado.
And Dhillon, frankly, has a history of working in the election denial space. She advised Trump's legal team in 2020 and also worked for Carrie Lake's campaign in Arizona in 2022, both campaigns that involved casting doubt on election results. And then up until the time she was confirmed, Dhillon was working at her own private firm, which was also commissioned by the Republican National Committee this spring to send out election records requests across the country. A Secretary of State not in Colorado, but who got one of those requests, told me she was getting flashbacks to the post-2020 period when voting officials really felt targeted more than ever before.
That's NPR's Miles Parks and Jude Joffe Block. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks.
At least five people have died in flash floods in West Virginia's northern panhandle, which is west of Pittsburgh. At least three others are still missing. Chris Schultz with West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
West Virginia Governor Patrick Morrisey declared a state of emergency for Ohio County yesterday morning after the region received 3 inches of rain or more in just 30 minutes. By evening, he declared another state of emergency for Marion County after flash flooding in the area of Fairmont caused the partial collapse of an apartment building. Rushing floodwaters picked up vehicles and washed out roads, bridges, and highways upstream of the city of Wheeling, but there was damage in the city too. Authorities conducted more than a dozen swift water rescues. Lou Vargo, Emergency Management Director for Wheeling and Ohio County, said the speed of the flood and the impact to local infrastructure has severely limited emergency response.
There was people in trees. We had a trailer on fire that the road on both sides of that was given out. We couldn't really get a response to it till some of that water receded.
Thousands remained without power yesterday as utility providers delayed restoring service until after natural gas leaks could be fixed. Vargo asked residents to submit formal damage declarations to assist in securing a federal disaster declaration. If approved by President Trump, it would be the second disaster declaration for West Virginia this year after three people died in flooding in the southern region in February. Governor Morrisey announced at a press conference yesterday afternoon the National Guard was mobilized to clear debris, reopen access routes, and support critical infrastructure.
We know that the National Guard aviation assets remain on standby to conduct search and rescue missions for individuals.
Morrisey said last night the focus remained on search and rescue, and assessing the full damage would begin today. For NPR News, I'm Chris Schultz in Morgantown, West Virginia.
This is NPR News.
Global instability has rejuvenated demand for tabletop war games, highly detailed simulations used to predict how conflict could unfold between world powers. The players take these games very seriously.
The whole point is to get people's heads into a situation, thinking about how they would actually act.
I'm Elsa Chang, a view inside the War Game Room on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Jail records show the man arrested for allegedly shooting Minnesota state lawmakers and their spouses is due to appear in court this afternoon. Vance Belter has been charged with two counts of murder in the deaths of former Democratic State House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark at their home Saturday morning. He's also charged with two counts of attempted murder in the attack on Democratic State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette. Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik has more.
Yvette Hoffman was struck by 8 bullets, and her husband, State Senator John Hoffman, was hit 9 times. Governor Walz said last night that John Hoffman came out of his final surgery and is moving toward recovery. Yvette Hoffman exchanged text messages with U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar yesterday, writing, quote, "We are both incredibly lucky to be alive."
The Israeli-Iran conflict is stretching into a fourth day over Tehran's nuclear program. Foreign affairs analyst and author Robin Wright, who's written about Iran for decades, warns it could get tougher for the U.S. not to become more actively involved.
I think everyone's trying to prevent an escalation that ripples over into the Gulf, impacting oil supplies. Then the U.S. could get sucked in.
Iran fired a new round of missiles at Israel early Monday. The Associated Press reports at least 8 deaths, and Israel has warned residents in Tehran to evacuate ahead of new strikes. You're listening to NPR News. All 50 states and U.S. territories have now approved a $7.4 billion settlement with Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, over the company's improper marketing of opioids. The deal was proposed by Purdue Pharma officials in March after negotiations with state attorneys general and other stakeholders. Payouts will occur over the next 15 years. Ukraine says it has received the bodies of 1,200 more Ukrainian soldiers killed in the war with Russia, part of a wider agreement with Russia to exchange both prisoners of war and the remains of the dead. And the fighting continues. NPR's Charles Means has the latest from Moscow.
Russia's defense ministry says its forces took control of another village in the Donetsk region, the latest advance in territory that Moscow has put a priority on capturing. It's one of 4 regions Russia claims to have annexed in 2022, but has never fully controlled. Separately, the ministry said Russian missiles targeted an oil refinery supplying fuel to Ukrainian forces in the region. Meanwhile, Ukraine launched more drone attacks deep inside Russia. In the latest, authorities in the Republic of Tatarstan said at least 2 people were dead after air defenses downed drones that subsequently fell on a local car factory. The area is also known for the production of Russian-made attack drones. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
U.S. stocks are trading higher this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 383 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Israel's war with Iran is drawing military resources from its other war in Gaza. But as NPR's Eyal Betraoui in Dubai and Anas Baba in Gaza report, Palestinians are still being killed and are under a near total blockade.
Israeli media reported over the weekend the military views the war in Gaza as secondary to its new front with Iran. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz quoted security officials as saying the military's beefing up its troop presence at Israel's borders with Syria and Jordan. To do this, Haaretz says, the number of soldiers in Gaza will drop by more than half. In Gaza, already fewer Israeli airstrikes have been reported in recent days. Israel's main focus is now Iran. But the death toll continues to mount in Gaza. Bodies streamed into the El Shifa hospital Saturday. Palestinians say large crowds of hungry people had amassed in a red zone that Israel's declared off limits. They were desperate to grab aid off trucks crossing into northern Gaza. Ibrahim Rajab says his son-in-law was killed trying to get a sack of flour to feed his four daughters. Witnesses say Israeli troops opened fire and launched artillery shells at the crowd near the border. Israel's military didn't respond to NPR's request for comment. NPR's Anas Baba describes the scene at El Shifa.
Now the family members are still mourning their own beloved, a 20-year-old guy that he was only seeking and aiming for one thing, which is a flour sack for his family that was starving for the past 3 months.
Gaza's health ministry says at least 300 people have been killed and more than 2,600 wounded in the past 3 weeks trying to reach food aid. The UN warns the territory could plunge into famine. Israel says its restrictions on aid are to keep it from reaching Hamas, the group that attacked Israel in 2023. Israel deems Hamas a proxy of Iran. Some Israeli officials say this war with Iran could advance Israel's aims in Gaza, which include eliminating Hamas. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday he sees an opening to advance negotiations on a temporary ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza. But mediators tell NPR talks remain frozen. In Israel, families of hostages who have been protesting Netanyahu to strike a deal have canceled their rallies due to Iranian missiles overhead. And at the UN, a conference where several Western countries were expected to formally recognize a Palestinian state has been postponed indefinitely. Ayel Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
We're going to hear now from someone who could be directly impacted by President Trump's travel ban on 12 countries. He's from Myanmar. And because of that, his plans to start a graduate program this fall at an Ivy League university have been thrown into question. We reached him in Thailand. And just a note, we are not using his name because he's afraid of losing his student visa or other retribution from the Trump administration. Our co-host Steve Inskeep asked him why extend his education in the U.S.
I was fascinated by, you know, American history, but also constitutional history, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. I think the idea and the evolution of the rights of habeas corpus, the rights of people to have a lawyer present, you know, were also very fascinating to me.
Are all of those different things, the right of free expression, the right of free speech, habeas corpus, which is the right to be brought before a judge if you're detained, are those things that you didn't always have in your home country growing up?
Yeah, exactly right. We never had these rights. I always intended to go back to my country. At that time, Myanmar was opening up. There were a lot of reforms going on politically, economically. It was a very interesting time to learn about these things because you were constantly thinking about, okay, we should have these in our country too, in our own way.
In more recent years, there was a military coup in your country, if I'm not mistaken.
Which brought me to Thailand. I'm in exile in Thailand essentially at the moment because I work in the human rights sector. I wouldn't be safe in Myanmar.
So you went on then to apply after a few years to graduate school at one of our Ivy League schools and were accepted. So first I should say congratulations.
Thank you.
When did you receive the acceptance letter?
It was middle of March.
And at this point, President Trump was already president and talking about mass deportations and so forth.
Around April, you started hearing about the travel ban. Mm-hmm. So I always expected this to happen, which is why I kind of nagged my school to give me my immigration documents as soon as possible so that I can secure my visa as fast as possible before, you know, additional restrictions are imposed.
Do you have the visa?
I do have a visa now, but just to be sure, I have also apply to universities elsewhere in case I'm not allowed entry to the U.S.
We had an immigration lawyer on our program who was talking about the exact wording of this travel order, and she observed that it was more precisely worded than some travel orders the president has issued in his previous term, and that some people can get in, even if some people are left out. Had you been going through this thing, looking at the exact wording and wondering what it means to you?
I sought guidance from my school, and they told me that since I have an existing visa, I am likely to be allowed to enter. So the keyword being likely. So that's where I am at the moment. I think I can gain entry, but it's a new regime, new law, so I don't know how it will play out.
There's a huge debate right now in the United States about international students, particularly at elite universities. The claim is made, the allegation is made, that it's not in the interest of the United States to let people in. Can you answer for yourself? Do you think it is in the interest of the United States to give you a chance at an education?
I would say it has always been. And we know for a fact that, you know, a lot of schools in the U.S. rely on international students and international talent and tuition paid by international students. But it's definitely in the interest of a lot of even smaller higher education institutions in the U.S.
Are you confident that Americans will welcome you regardless of the political situation here?
I have no doubt about that. I think whatever going on at the federal political level, I don't think that's the America that I know. The people I have met, I studied at a very rural college. There was never a time that I didn't feel welcome, and I expect that to continue.
One of the things on my mind, we have seen some early indications that there might be a decrease in student interest in the United States, and it's very early. I don't think we can conclude anything. Speaking again just for yourself, do you still want to come to the United States?
I do, but it makes one think. Because of this travel ban, even if I can gain entry and finish my program, I will not be able to have my family come over for my graduation, for example. And even if when I'm studying, I cannot go on study abroad trips, you know, short exchange trips, because of the fear of running into potential visa issues. So if your travel in and out of the country is this much restricted, you start questioning if it's even worth it.
A student from Myanmar talking with Steve Inskeep after President Trump's travel ban on 12 countries, including Myanmar, raised questions about his ability to go to graduate school in the U.S. This is NPR News.
Israel's attack on Iran's nuclear and military facilities is reverberating across the Middle East. We'll bring you the latest developments next time in Here and Now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Martin. Some people lose their minds over art. Some just lose their balance. That's what happened to a couple at a museum in Verona, Italy, when they saw a sculpture of a chair inspired by a Van Gogh painting covered in Swarovski crystals. The note said not to touch it. The couple took pictures pretending to sit on it until one of them fell, breaking two legs in the seat, and fled. The museum director put out the word, hoping to remind people to be more considerate. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The U.S. is no longer a player in the commercial shipbuilding business. President Trump wants to change that. Stephen Bisaha of the Gulf States Newsroom reports from a city that historically was one of America's biggest shipbuilders.
There's this old rotted-out dock a short drive from Mobile, Alabama, mostly just loose planks and some scattered pylons sticking out of the Tensaw River. This is the graveyard of the Ghost Fleet.
No, it's a spooky sight, for sure.
John Sledge is a historian at the National Maritime Museum of the Gulf. At one time, this dock was filled with hundreds of Liberty ships. Thousands were built during World War II to carry needed supplies to Europe. Commercial ships are often called up during wartime for supply runs.
When you think about war, we always think about the sharp end of the spear, but all of that support and logistics is absolutely vital.
And the U.S. decided after World War II to keep these Liberty ships around for decades to use in future wars.
And that was the origin of the Ghost Fleet. Let's mothball these vessels so that should the alarm go up, they can quickly be remobilized and put into service.
But those ships have since been decommissioned, and the days of the U.S. as a major commercial shipbuilder are gone. And that's a serious problem for the country's national security, according to Republican lawmakers, Democrats, and Bradley Byrne. He's the head of the Mobile Chamber of Commerce.
I think it's been bad for America and certainly bad for our area that we produce so few commercial ships in the United States.
Now, the U.S. does have private shipyards, typically building military ships. But it costs about four times as much to build a commercial ship in the U.S. compared to a country like China, which is the largest maker of ships in the world. In fact, in 2022, China built nearly 1,800 huge ocean-crossing commercial ships. The U.S. built just five.
So what if we're in a war with China? We can't use their ships. So this is a national security problem as much as it is a problem for our economy.
So the Trump administration's solution? Make Chinese ships pay to dock. Starting in October, any Chinese-built or operated commercial ship will be charged port fees. American ships won't have to pay, so they'll be cheaper to use. And that's causing those private U.S. shipyards to consider getting back into the commercial game. Chris Kastner is the head of HII. It's the largest shipbuilder in the U.S. During a recent earnings call, he said there are a lot of tailwinds behind commercial shipbuilding.
Now, it's not easy. It takes time. These are heavy manufacturing facilities and equipment, but I think it's only positive for HII and positive for shipbuilding.
Of course, there are a lot of headwinds, too, including tariffs that are depressing international trade. Mike Lee runs the shipping logistics company Page & Jones out of Mobile.
There's an old proverb I'd heard that said, you don't kill a mosquito on your friend's forehead with a hatchet.
What he means is that tariffs have already caused a drop in trade into U.S. ports. So there isn't much need to build new ships when trade is down.
I don't know why you would invest in a ship right now, even an American flagship or a Chinese flagship. I think you're going to see shipyards falling off around the world, even in China and Korea and the places that they're all moving to.
These new port fees will be based on cargo size. And Lee says consumers will ultimately have to pay for them with higher prices. Now, shippers could avoid these troubled waters by using ships made in America, but building new ships could take years. These new port fees start in October. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Mobile, Alabama.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Anne Akiko Myers is a very busy violinist these days. She's released 3 albums in 3 months. They feature new music she's commissioned by contemporary composers. Myers recently carved out some time for us to meet us at our studios in Culver City, California, and she came equipped.
I brought a very special violin that was made in 1741. And it was made by Guarneri del Gesù. And this is a really rare instrument. The power and the resonance of this instrument is pretty much unparalleled.
Yeah, this is an instrument that is worth, what, $16, $17 million?
I mean, that was back in 2012.
Wow.
I mean, it's a Monet.
Tell us about the first moment that you had it in your hands and you played it. What was that like?
It was amazing. The second I put my bow to the string, it was like the heavens parted. And the G string is so rich, and the E string is so cathedral-like in its resonance.
Can you play us a little something that would kind of give the listeners a sense of what you just described?
Okay.
It's just me applauding, but I'm going to give you what I got. So you have 3 albums coming out in the span of, what, about 3 months?
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot. I don't know.
It is.
Is it a lot? Okay.
It is a lot.
Okay. I mean, why would you do that to yourself?
I know. I've been asking myself that, actually. The first one is a violin concerto by Michael Doherty, and it's inspired by Amelia Earhart. And it's called Blue Electra. And I feel her when I play it. She was so courageous in being able to fly this plane across the Atlantic and then the Pacific.
How do you get in that headspace?
Well, I really researched a lot about her. I was so fascinated by the freedom that she felt when she was in the air. Her poetry, which is, you can hear in the first movement, it's actually called Courage.
Mm-hmm.
this mysterious ending to her is captured really in the music as well. And Michael did a very genius thing with the music in that the last note, I've never played anything like it. The entire orchestra and myself, we sound like her engine.
The Billy Childs piece, what's the story with that one?
So Billy Childs, In the Arms of the Beloved, it's called, is his first requiem. And it was written in honor of his mother. And I play his mother's voice.
That's a big responsibility,
yeah.
Right? It sounds like it is.
I told him to clean his room a lot.
Did you?
What about with Philip Glass? What was that like?
So I recorded his violin concerto, number one, and I was just jumping up and down. I'd got this date to perform it at the Hollywood Bowl, and I decided, you know, you might as well ask.
Yeah.
He actually wrote this new chaconne, which is a new work for him. I was like, wow. I mean, when it was sent to me, I just couldn't believe it.
And I saw you, like, you were shaking a little bit when you were describing it. I mean, it still gets you then, right?
Yeah. This is for the canon of violin literature, and it will live on forever.
I always think about the intellectual accessibility of this kind of music. Do you worry sometimes that for people that maybe want to listen to this, but maybe feel intimidated by it, that maybe they won't ever expose themselves to it?
That would be the greatest shame of all time, because music was written to feel emotions. It's not an intellectual exercise.
But do you think at all that accessibility is somehow frowned upon in contemporary classical music, where a lot of the works are prized because of their complexity, because there's so much happening? No?
No. That doesn't work for me. I don't go to a concert to want to practice my intellectual. Like, no, thank you.
Yeah, so how do you then bridge the gap between those perceptions and then on the other side, increasing the appeal of these new works that you've commissioned?
Well, I'm here to tell the stories of these composers. These composers just have so much to say, and they are walking amongst us, these giants.
That is violinist Anne Akiko Myers. Thank you for coming here. Thank you for bringing what you brought. That was amazing. Thank you so much. Is there anything that you could play us out on?
Smile, okay. By Charlie Chaplin.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.